This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 9th of August 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 318 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck.
On the show today, we'll chat to Peter York, the London style and culture guru, whose new show looks at how he and you can become a nicer person. If that were at all possible, he'll be here a little later on.
And we'll be talking photography with Chris Coe, the founder of the Travel Photographer of the Year event.
Plus, journalist and filmmaker Sam Collins will be here to tell us why the reassuring smack of willow on leather, cricket that is, has lost its way a little and how it can be steered back on course.
That's all to come. Plus, Tom Edwards will be peering into the future of news in the News Look Ahead. We'll play some great music too, right here on Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So there we have it, Andrew. It's been a nice, relaxing week in the office. You've made a small mark on your desk by putting your feet up. Am I right? There goes.
Excuse me. What,
it's been
what?
Nice knowing you, listeners. I've just been sacked live on air.
It hasn't been that calm over my side of the desk, actually. It's one of those weird, just like gritty things to do.
I've done a lot of ticking things
gritty,
off of
gritty.
This. Gritty. What are you talking? Is this the Monocle Guide to Street Art? What is this?
Hold on. I did have to dodge a show this week when I was meant to be interviewing people about rap music, which...
You did? I saw you literally dodged that. So I'm just putting it down on your desk. The briefing notes for this. This is an arts review.
And I read it. It was like, you know, book about rap music, two books about rap. I thought, actually, this is a bit wrong.
You could borrow a baseball cap, put it on sideways, Andrew. I think it'd be good.
No, but we did our sneaker chat last week, and I think that's been a bit of a hit. Lots of people...
It's been a hit on the social internet.
On the social internet.
Is that what they call it? Social... What do they call it?
I think with the sneakerheads of this world, they liked it. And I'm pleased.
I know who sports a fine pair of shoes. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? It's the News Look Ahead.
Who's that moving at the speed of light? Darting around the globe with his golden cape a flutter, waggling his chunky glasses, and giving us a knowing wink as he passes. His cuddly beauty silhouetted against the stars. Who could have such a wise yet pretty face? Or such a wiggly bottom? Could it be? Oh yes, it's Monocle's very own Clark Kent, our intrepid reporter and all-round lifesaver. And look, he's coming into land. Please welcome the one and only Super Tedwards, the news bear who likes his stories served with ice cream, please. We love you, Super Tedwards.
No, it's only 4 weeks.
Just let it wash over you, Andrew. That's it.
It's only 4 weeks until you have a baby. Are you going to put all these in like a time capsule for him when he kind of grows old?
And bury it deep underground. That's correct. That is exactly what I'm going to do.
Do you know my daddy? He's the news bear. I think he's going to be saying
news
that.
Bear. Yeah. I'm sure he'll be incredibly proud.
Of your wiggly bottom?
Possibly.
What is that
sound effect? I don't know what that
is
one
that
is.
One of the it's like a Count Duckula thing or something.
Exactly. It's cartoony. I'll take it.
Give us some news.
Where should we start? We've got a few things happening this week. A couple of sort of stories about, you know, nation states and independence, because there's a serious news look ahead. Singapore celebrates its Independence Day today, in fact. What now? 50 years since it became fully independent. And that's rather interesting. And I've got a couple of others. So we've been talking about Cuba, haven't we, in recent weeks? And the reintegration of Cuba.
Yeah.
Do you know what John Kerry's doing on Friday?
Is he playing golf there?
He'll probably go for a round of golf, I bet. But he is raising the flag above the US embassy.
In Havana. Actually in Havana.
He's actually going there to do it, yeah. Now, obviously, we've been talking about how Cuba might change, all this kind of thing. And you asked about the notable days. That's on Friday. On Thursday, it's Fidel's birthday, 89.
Is he going to hang around, do you think? Pop in and see Fidel? Give him a gift?
I don't know, to be honest. Because of this thawing, they've been having some chat. And of course he...
Because maybe they're having a party.
Party? That's pretty good. Rob looked sort of unmoved by that one.
That won't make it into the final show.
I think that's quite true. But obviously one of the things I find quite compelling about this is that there's a lot of rumour about Fidel, you know, that he's not around, the state of his health and this kind of thing. Mm. But it's his birthday on Thursday and then Kerry's there on Friday. So it could be a big week, Havana side.
Yeah, exactly. Crack open the rum.
Mm. Now, mainly, there's lots of other fun things happening this week. From Tuesday here in London, it's the Great British Beer Festival. And this was always an annual fixture for me. But it's rather been overtaken by the sort of craft brewing movement, which is a great thing because that's, you know, lots of great products, lots of great small businesses that are started out. But I thought we should still mention it because it's run by Camera and it's a lot of it is about pubs.
Is this at Earl's Court? Or is this like, does this happen throughout pubs around London?
Well, there's various events, but it's principally at Olympia. And it went to Earl's Court for a time. Now it's back at Olympia, which is the best venue for it. But it's mainly about pubs and they are still, I think, a lot of the glue, a bit of that social cohesion.
So on a Friday, you're going to stop nipping out to get your cans of Stella and have them in the office?
Listeners, I don't do that. I'm much more discriminating than that when it comes to my drinks. So cheers to them.
Cheers to them, yeah. Should we do a report live from the London Beer Festival for next week's programme?
What do you think about that, Andrew?
That sounds great.
Sign off a modest expenses claim for that?
I thought Rob was going to the gin festival. I thought that's the one he had lined up.
I think where Rob should actually go from Wednesday, and this is running for nearly 2 weeks, so you've got plenty of time, it's the World Tango Championships in Buenos Aires.
Oh, man, send me to
that. Now, come on, that's got to be.
Yeah.
Can imagine Rob cutting a few shapes there. So you have all sorts of things. You have the traditional milonga ballroom tango, the sort of very authentic, you know, from, and then a more sort of European style choreographed. Maybe that's more your, I don't know, Rob. I don't know what you'd be. Maybe that's more yours. And it came, you know, out of Buenos Aires, and that's where it's all happening.
I love the idea of that. That sounds absolutely fantastic. Mm. That's two OBs that need to be sorted out. I don't know whether I can spare the time to go to Buenos Aires. I'll just be at Olympia.
That's on for 2 weeks. So you could do Olympia easy. This week, bang.
Bang.
Spot a tango.
I'll see you in a bit.
One final one.
Go for it.
To continue our sort of pursuit of British hysterica that I know you enjoy. It's the Worthing, Sussex, Worthing Birdman competition. You know this one?
Oh, yeah.
You've probably seen this.
People have to try and fly, don't they? They're with flapping wings.
Exactly.
And they dive off the end of a pier.
Marvellous men with their flying machines. It's completely crackers. There's a special ramp on the pier. Three different sort of classes of attempted flight.
Yeah.
So that the people can decide whether they're there for aviation or just for a few laughs.
So you get sort of feathers on arms and you get complete sort of Wright brothers.
Well, there's
jobs.
A lot of sort of bicycle biplanes and this sort of thing. You get £10,000 for the furthest flight over 100 metres. Which is quite serious.
That's a long way.
But you can be descending throughout.
Has anyone ever won it?
Occasionally. They mainly do it for, you know, sensational crashing.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I thought maybe next year, monocle entrant.
Who do you think's a good engineer in the monocle?
He wants to do it. You've got your little cape, haven't you? You're just like...
Yeah.
Super Ted Woods. Just in flight.
You just wiggle your bottom and off you'd go.
Tremendous power can be generated by that.
Yeah.
One to think about.
Bear in the air. I think it's going to work.
An air bear. I'll take it.
Well, Tom, thank you very much. A fine look ahead to the week ahead, even.
From Istanbul.
From Hong Kong.
This is Monocle 24.
Tokiosta. Tämä on Monocle 24.
こちらは Monocle 24です。Questa è Monocle 24.
To Paris. To Munich.
From London.
To Berlin.
To Istanbul.
To Frankfurt.
To Zurich.
To Madrid.
To Singapore.
To Barcelona.
To Toronto.
To Helsinki.
To New York.
To Lisbon.
To Tokyo.
Broadcasting around the world, around the clock.
Monocle 24.
From Midori House in London, you're tuned to Monocle 24.
Now, Peter York is no stranger to the Monocle 24 studios. He's often here to talk fashion, culture or art, as his razor-sharp eye for what's good in those worlds is held in high regard by the world and by us, Robert.
Indeed, but lately he's been looking at himself rather than the gallery wall or the catwalk floor to learn what the man who coined the term Sloane Ranger can become a nicer person. If it sounds odd, that's because it is. Peter will be heading to the Edinburgh Festival soon with his show How to Become a Nicer Person and instructing the masses on just that. But first he's going to tell Andrew and I how in order to do just that. Peter, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
So this sounds like a properly didactic show, How to Become a Nicer Person. Is this the sort of thing that people should be taking notes in?
They should be taking notes. I encourage them to take notes.
It is very didactic. It's a magic lantern lecture, a Victorian magic lantern lecture, a Gladstonian lecture.
You'd be holding your lapels throughout.
I'd be holding my lapels throughout. And it's all about the words to use and the words not to use, the things to wear and things not to wear.
And if we can distill it into a thing, is this going to be words and pictures? Is this going to be, are you projecting to the back of the room?
Yes, I've had to learn to project. It's very difficult. I've had to learn to be like those fruity old actors, the Wallington Minge type actors. You know,
it's my favourite type of carpet.
Yes, where you say, you get the shoes right, darling, and you've got the man. Well, I've done two tryouts where I haven't had a mic. So I've had to learn. I mean, I'm quite noisy. I'm quite loud. Mm. But I haven't actually ever been taught to do that thing so you can make the rafters ring. So I've had to project more than is altogether comfortable.
So there's no miking up on the day?
In Edinburgh, I'll have a team of helpers.
Good.
A team of helpers. Of course, I'll be throat miked.
And tell me, because everyone's thinking that Benedict Cumberbatch's performance is the one that everyone's waiting for, but I'm sure this is the one, really, that we should be... Are you nervous? Are you thinking this is a change of pace? Because you talk to the public all the time.
I talk to the public all the time. I do all sorts of show-off things. But this is a different sort of show-off thing, because it's slightly autobiographical. I mean, it's not confessional, but it's got autobiographical elements. It's about oneself. And also, the normal comforts of a speech where you stand there and read it and you don't do anything else, or you look into the autocue and you don't do anything else. I'm very good at reading speeches and at looking into the autocue. It's a doddle. Do you know, I could be a newsreader. Easy.
I know that the other annoying thing is that some people have gone before you in recent years and done rather well at this, haven't they? There's Nancy Dell'Olio, who was, you know,
yes,
in this country as being the partner of the British, English rather, football manager. But does that make you a bit nervous that you know that other people have done rather well?
No. Nancy has been a great inspiration to me, as she is in all things. And my stablemate, Jeremy Paxman, another great inspiration. And Virginia Ironside, the agony aunt, who is now in the stratosphere of touring performers.
And is that the thing? Can you pick and choose things? Or was the subject matter immediately apparent, what you had to do?
It's absolutely immediately apparent, because it's grown out of my last book.
Yeah.
My last book was a short polemic about the idea, the word and the idea of authenticity as it's used mainly by Americans, but it's infected us in the 21st century. And so when I did it, when I talked about it at lit fests and things like that, I got rather ranty and shouty. And then I started adding things. As time went on, I started adding things to my shtick for this. I would, you know, put pictures on the wall and say, look at him, no better than he ought to be, and stuff like that. and it grew and grew. And then I was telling my friend, Mr. Tim Fountain. Do you know Mr. Fountain?
I do. Yeah.
Mr. Fountain is the author of plays about one-person show-offs or things which are a torrent of filth. There's no other way of describing it. He does things which are a torrent of filth. And in turn, he said, this could become something in Edinburgh. And then he introduced me to his friend, Mr. Johnson. And since I've been groomed by predatory men, that's it. that's what's happened.
And why did you say yes? What's the allure for you?
Well,
Apart from showing off,
I wanted to see what you could do. And I was very aware of quite a lot of my friends and contemporaries doing it and thinking, well, that's what you do now. I want to do it.
What can we glean from the title? Because it's not how to be a better person, how to be a nicer person, I like. But
you can read it in lots of ways. The first thing is, in contradistinction to all the people, or 90% of the people in Edinburgh, are saying, look at me, I'm dark, edgy and subversive, and I'm not 38, I'm 19. Or look at me, I have deep feelings and I'm emo, and I'm not 38, I'm 19. So I'm saying, what about being nice? Wouldn't that be very subversive to be nice? And also, there's if you're a certain type of person, you might take it in slightly Alan Bennett-y ways, because you can imagine Alan Bennett describing his mum saying, oh, they were a nice type of person.
And the cups of tea in the other.
Yes.
Okay. Without wanting to plot spoil, Peter, are there a couple of key points that our listeners can take away that can, when they're motoring to Edinburgh, they can hold in their hearts?
That there is a wholly immersive, interactive, participative scarf action for men workshop. So, in which I explain what your scarf is saying about you. And people come onto the stage and talk about their scarf choices, and I read their scarf choices and explain the vocabulary of scarves, so to speak.
Are you going to explain the scarf knot as well? Because there's a kind of a London way of doing your scarf, isn't there? Yes, that one, that one.
Yes.
I don't know where that came from then. It was suddenly, you know, de rigueur.
Yes. Well, I call it the mum's net. And there's another, which, well, there's a variety. There's one called the Nigel Havers. You know, I don't know.
Robert, I think yours is a bit Nigel Havers.
My scarf.
Yeah, you do a little bit of a flick back, don't you?
There's
a lot of rapping and then a bit of a flick.
And then there's another. I think it needs a flick. Another called the Andre Leon Talley.
Well, that's with a piece of chicken wire to hold it up.
Yes,
it's a very large structure. Marcel wave for a scarf. Yes.
And a matching caftan.
Absolutely. Yes. Are you going to be nice in the show in order to show people how to be nice, or will you have to be quite strict?
No, I'm going to have to be quite strict. I'm going to say, don't do this.
Right.
You know, here's something, don't do it. Don't let's even talk about this. It's so awful, don't do it. So in that sense, I'm being quite strict.
Schoolmasterly.
Yes. I was going to say, being nice, though, one of the benefits, hopefully, is that people won't be heckling and coming in drunkenly.
Well,
they'll feel on their best behaviour.
Well, it's on at half past one. So, I mean, of course,
we all
want to go to Glasgow and have loaded bottles of beer thrown at us, but not this time, I don't.
Maybe the odd plastic champagne flute.
Maybe the odd plastic champagne flute. That's about about my size.
And that's the thing, there's going to be audience participation in this. Are you yet accustomed to picking a wrong un or a right un out of the audience?
Well,
that's the first couple of shows.
Yesterday we had a completely marvellous volunteer in the Scarf Action for Men workshop. And
your agent sent Nigel Havers.
And he was somebody who clearly and wonderfully, though a young person, was a retro young person, a harking back young person. He wanted to be Nigel Havers. So I was able to explain to him, do you know, he didn't know this, but I said, you want to be Nigel Havers, don't you? And he said, oh, yes.
Oh, that's good, because you see, it's the trouble in our office. If you said Nigel Havers to half the people in our office, they
wouldn't know who it was.
Well, no, their memory, it's kind of began like 12 months ago.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not very useful.
No.
Lots of people, that's something that you could, is to my chagrin, is that people who don't have a memory before when they were born.
Yeah.
As if they don't know any history or
that is, it is an extraordinary, it's a very, very important cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
And not having, it's partly about the Google mentality where you don't have to commit anything to mind. It's partly about teaching practice where they think, you know, committing things to mind is learning by rote, dame school and bad for you, which means people don't commit things to mind apart from what they're absolutely made to. They don't. And I think that if you commit lots of different things to mind, when they've gone in there, they interbreed.
Yeah.
You know, they make little connections between each other, and they have little conversations in there, and suddenly you've got something.
Well, I always think it's because, you know, I always said to Robert, what's interesting is I grew up, you know, that TV was so rubbish that on a Saturday, unless you wanted to kind of watch the football results, you had to turn over to BBC Two, where there was just endless movies from the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. Yeah. And they were way before my time, but you knew who all the stars were. You knew a bit of history of film by the time you were 10 years old. And now that doesn't happen because there's so much good TV in a way. You can always be watching the latest serial and getting the latest thing from Amazon. And you never think to go and watch all these old, dusty films, which, as you say, inform you actually about everything you're watching today.
The Blitz kids, who are now mid-50s, were brought up on those things. That's where they got their costumes from. They'd watched lots of old black and white movies on TV because they didn't want to watch the football.
Well, I was one of them watching, certainly avoiding all those football results.
Yeah.
One last one on how to become a nicer person, Peter. Is this a bit of reaction? Is it this didactic idea with this? Is that a bit of reaction against the carey-sherey, maybe you should try this? Yes. It's a bit more like, this is vile, don't do it.
It's very much against therapy culture. It's very much against the confessional culture. It's very much against talking about yourself too much. It sounds almost stiff upper lipped, but it's a new way of being stiff upper lipped rather than the old one. But it's saying, don't talk about yourself. Don't make those, you know, Remember, Dame Edna used to say, I'm feeling very caring today. You know, that sort of thing. And, you know, she picked up on it very early on, that confessional strand in American culture, which is now ours through YouTube. Because, you know, when you start on YouTube, what are you thinking about today?
There's always some bon mot being sent to you on your email as well about being caring and sharing.
There's nothing wrong with being right, is there?
There's nothing wrong with being right, says an old lefty like me.
I think, we saw the dancing partner you brought to our Monocle party.
Polly Toynbee.
Polly Toynbee.
Polly Toynbee. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. That was an amusing evening. I seem to remember. Shall we push our listeners in the direction of how to be a nicer person? Is it at the assembly rooms in Edinburgh?
It's at the assembly rooms, but it's not the old assembly rooms people are familiar with on George Street. It's something quite else on the fringe. Does it say on the bit of paper I gave you what it is, where it is? There is the full direction.
No.
it ought to.
I don't think it does. It just says Assembly Room. Ah, yes. Assembly George Square Studios.
Assembly George Square Studios. I mean, it's a converted university lecture room. So you've got those things to put your elbows on. It's not the magic of velvet swathed Victorian theatre.
But I'm
going to make it feel like that. I've got a portion of my wardrobe there to teach people about what is right and wrong in a shirt, for instance. So I've got a variety of shirts where I can do a little shirt workshop.
We haven't noticed how neither you or I, Andrew, have asked Peter. But I know he's looked at my shoes already.
Oh, I'm sure he's looked at all parts of my dress. But anyway, we did have a good discussion about shoes the other day. I got a pair of shoes past him. That was okay. So.
Yeah. The Alden, and I realised I bought the church's counterpart of this, and it was some extraordinary zeitgeistal thing, thinking those very chunky church's shoes are right for now. So, covered with enthusiasm, I went in and bought them in brown and black. They're called Grafton. And they're just like your American ones.
My Aldens.
It's a very, very
I like the way he says American before, because you know that you've done slightly the wrong thing. But anyway.
No. You're right.
Thank you for being so nice, Peter.
And How to Become a Nicer Person is on at the Assembly George Square Studios in Edinburgh for the 17th to the 31st of August. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Up next, we'll be talking photography with Chris Coe. Time for some music first. We've just been hearing how Peter York might soon hope to become a nicer person. So here's LA's The OCs with So Nice. That was LA's The OCs with So Nice.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Travel Photographer of the Year is a selection of some of the best pictures taken in less storied pockets of the world around us. And each year, some of the best are showcased at London's Royal Geographical Society.
Founded in 2003, the event now attracts entrants from over 100 nations. The winner in 2014 was British Philip Lee Harvey, whose images of Namibia's Himba tribe earned him the top billing in the current show. The winner for 2015 won't be decided for another couple of months. But in the meantime, here to tell us what makes for a great shot and about the other images on show, is Travel Photographer of the Year founder and a photographer himself, Chris Coe. Chris, welcome to the programme. And first of all, looking at the selection of images that you're showing this year, there's nature photography in there, there's kind of anthropological stuff. As we said, there's Namibian tribes and all that stuff. How on earth do you start to define what a travel photograph and a travel photographer is?
Well, for me, travel photography encompasses a number of other different genres, and that was one of the reasons for setting up the awards. Photographers often get pigeonholed, so they're landscape photographers or they're wildlife photographers, but travel encompasses all of these and much more. So it's wildlife, it's people, it's food, it's history, it's places, it's landscapes, it's leisure activities as well. So what I've done with the awards is design them deliberately so that we reflect all of this by having different theme categories, which we change every year to keep it all fresh and vibrant.
And is your kind of decision-making process helped by travel magazines, as in what might fit into one of those? And this is everything from National Geographic to something like Condé Nast Traveler or Monocle, actually, some of the pages of Monocle. Are those some of the things that help you draw the parameters, or you can see some of the inspiration for things that might have started off as editorial projects that end up in your show?
Well, I think reflected in the winners are obviously some of those trends. But what we do with the awards is design the categories so that sometimes they have an editorial theme to them. Sometimes it's more advertising or conceptually led. Sometimes it's led by beautiful images, sometimes by more documentary, reportage and grittier images. So it's mixing all of those together that gives it such a diverse set of imagery in the final set in the exhibition.
And Chris, I'm hoping I'm not misjudging this. The images we've seen that we looked before you came on air, they tend to be more nature than, say, travel to cities or travel in dense urban environments. Is that the kind of flavour you're looking at? Are you looking at the more, maybe it's kind of some of the essence that found in things like National Geographic, those kind of those wilder shores, those more distant places?
Not really, no. I would love to see more images entered from common European destinations and the UK, but we can obviously only judge what we receive. We do change the categories each year, as I said. So the set in this particular exhibition, we had one category which was themed earth, air, fire, water, which attracted a lot of landscape and remote destination type shots. Another one that was wildlife orientated, or at least natural world orientated, and others that were people and culture. But in the current awards, which are running at the moment and close on the 1st of October, we've got a street culture category. So you can expect to see a different type of image from that category in the next exhibition.
And before we look at some of the pictures, what was your kind of thought behind starting the awards? What did you think was lacking from the photography world that needed recognition?
It was a moment of frustration that's ended up in a massive project. As a travel photographer, I was aware of how difficult it was to get at that particular time in 2002, 2003, to get anything but rather predictable travel images published. And I was also aware of a number of photographers, really good photographers, who couldn't get interesting shots into the media. So I thought, I'll create a showcase. And that's how the whole thing came about. And obviously the environment has changed dramatically since then, with really the birth of good digital cameras and the spread of the internet. It's much easier for photographers to get their work out there, but there's still a place for something that showcases the very best of it.
So show us one or two of the images which are standouts for you from the current exhibition and which you'd like to talk us through.
So just so you have the context of it, there's three portfolio categories, which are sets of four images. There's three single image categories, which obviously are a single shot, but each with a different theme. There's a Young Travel Photographer of the Year, which is split into two age groups, 15 to 18 and 14 and under, and then we choose an overall winner from that. And there's a New Talent category, which is for anyone who's aspiring to turn professional, and an HD Video category, which is something we introduced in 2012 for films shot on stills cameras. So that's the spectrum that you're dealing with.
Now, one of the pictures that we liked, me and Rob, when we were looking through earlier, is of this polar bear that seems to be eating the carcass, I'm not sure, of a seal up in Svalbard. It looks like the seal is, the polar bear is completely white, but it's got a very pink face. It almost looks like makeup. It looks almost playful. And then you see that it is because of this kind of huge carcass on the floor.
I love that shot. And in the exhibition, we're asking visitors to vote for their favourite pictures. That's currently the top.
Is it?
People's favourite in there. I think it's also a really important shot. because it says so much about the environment that the polar bears are living in, the whole issue of global warming and the struggle for survival.
I mean, that could have been wearing a lumberjack shirt, that carcass. They're heading into the cities. But that's an interesting one. And actually, one of the things that Andrew and I liked about that shot was the fact that it's tough. It shows nature is red in tooth and claw. It is not just a beautiful flotilla of butterflies in an English meadow. It is not just, you know, the majesty of a lion or a tiger in its natural habitat, but it shows a bit of mess. Is that something that you believe in yourself, that you kind of want to see some harder images?
Yes, I the awards are inspiring for people who come and view the exhibition, but I think it's also really important that the less glamorous side of travel is in there as well. So in last year's exhibition, for example, we had a burnt out carcass of a baby elephant by the side of the road. And there was a shot of a young lad, probably only 4 or 5 years old, being weaned into the family business of shooting alligators. So these things are all part of the travel process. It's not just the pretty stuff that you see, but they're really engaging for people, and it makes them stop and think about things that they don't see every day in the media.
I like the cycling series as well up in Norway. That's beautiful. I guess because there's a kind of you get some sense of scale of the kind of the lone cyclist often just heading through this kind of really remote kind of landscape. Mm. And I think that's the moments that kind of, you know, tug you in. Being a little bit challenging, so I guess some of the photography, as you say, that some of these people are doing commercial work, I presume, as well. There is that kind of slightly kind of long exposure, running water things, which, you know, there are a few of those images in. Do you put them in there because you recognise that these people are looking for commercial work as well? Because I wonder if, the world of... It's quite hard to get people to connect emotionally with photography, especially if they've seen a kind of image many times before. Is there a bit of a challenge around that commercial notion of travel, do you think?
Not at all. It's not even a consideration. The awards, 55% of the entrants are amateurs. Complete amateurs, they don't sell their work at all. It's probably about another 20-25% who are semi-pros, so they'll sell the odd image, but it's not their main living. And that leaves about 20% professionals. So we're looking for great photography. I don't care how it's used, and I'm not really interested in that element.
It's so it's just as likely the person who wins will be a non-professional photographer.
Yeah,
as
we've had plenty of amateur winners, including the top award.
Brilliant.
And what about, we said in the introduction that the nominees or the entrants, rather, come from 100 nations or the rest of it. Have you seen that change? Have you seen people, different countries taking up cameras than was the case 100 years ago when you maybe saw more British, more European, American entries? Do you see different people picking up their camera with a serious intent these days?
I think it's hard to be sure on that because obviously as the awards spread around the world, we don't know if we're just reflecting people's awareness of the awards or a change in photography. But I think photography is much more accessible nowadays and more people are doing it. And interestingly, my children's generation are starting with phones, and I'm not a big fan of mobile phone photography, but it's a step in. And if they're doing something interesting with a phone, then gets them to buy a camera that's a basic camera, and then they get interested enough to buy another camera, then that's great news. And I think the kids' photography is fantastic. They have no fear.
Yeah, so that's the thing with anything that's done by children, whether it's storytelling or whether it's painting, there's an artlessness to the art, right? There's something very honest about the gaze, I presume, right?
Mm-hmm. And also, I think the kids, they will, as I said, we have themes, so they will shoot their pictures to the theme, whereas an adult would tend, first of all, to go to their existing set of pictures and try and find a picture that fits or a set of pictures that fits. And I think it shows. I think it shows with the people who've really considered the themes of the categories and either shot or had a shoot that would fit that category, they stand out above those that are trying to cobble together a portfolio from various different places.
And you break down the categories. So some people have done portfolios, as you say, and some people, this is really, you know, they've just caught that one moment, kind of decisive moment that they've seen something and they've managed to seize it. So you don't have to have a huge portfolio then to enter the awards.
No, the whole idea is that it's open to everyone and inclusive for everyone. So we have three portfolio categories, and we choose the overall winner of the awards from those portfolio categories. But there are a number of single image categories for someone who's a less serious photographer who's got a great shot, doesn't preclude the other photographers from entering it as well. And some of the kids enter those as well. It's just, we have something for everyone in the awards. This year we've actually added a smartphone category as well, just to recognise that really the way that so many youngsters especially are coming to it, and also to engage with people who just travel on with a camera on a less serious basis. They're not going for photography, they're going for the experience, but they take pictures of it.
Nice. Well, so many of those pictures are very handsome indeed. It is the Travel Photographer of the Year. It's at the Royal Geographical Society in London. And that closes on Saturday, the 5th of September. Chris Coe, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, the Monocle Travel Guides. And the series kicks off with London and with New York City. New York used to be such an easy city to crack for the visitor, but now its focus has fractured and shifted. Why not let Monocle help you to navigate?
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Monocle has had a bureau in New York since its launch in 2007, and our travel guide is a celebration of all that we know and love about this place. We put together a list of the finest places and experiences the Big Apple has to offer, be it a cozy stay at the Cosby Street Hotel, a late drink in a classic bar like King Cole in Midtown, or a top-notch fuss-free trim at Cheez In Brooklyn. Let us take you beyond the obvious to reveal the hidden spots New York has to offer. Published by Gestalten, these books are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists. So pick up the Monocle Travel Guide to New York in Monocle shops, at monocle.com, and in all good bookstores. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
When sports journalists Sam Collins and Jarrod Kimber turned their camera to the supposedly gentlemanly game of cricket, they had no idea what lurked at the dark heart of the second most beautiful game, it says here.
The film starts inspecting the health of the sport and ends as a big scoop that shines a light on malpractice, ego, and inevitably, billions of dollars sloshing around the boundaries of the world. Rob spoke to Sam a little earlier to get to the bottom of it all.
Sam, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. First of all, did you make the film that you set out to make?
No.
And you're glad for that,
it's the short answer, I think, right? Definitely glad. No, there was a point, I think, we started out idealistically thinking, well, just, you know, test cricket is quite, such a sort of, cricket is an interesting area. There's so many things about it that are sort of fascinating. I mean, it's a sort of microcosm of the game, isn't it? That's why so many people love the game.
Yeah.
That we thought, well, look, if we put a camera on this, something's bound to come up. And there was a point after about a year probably when we were like, help.
Yeah.
Right. As, you know, what?
As in you've got too much stuff that you don't know what you're doing, or you've kind of suddenly opened a can of worms.
Well, no, like that we were making like one of those films that about the financial crisis before the financial crisis happened. Do you know, so there was that point where we knew we had all this very, very interesting stuff that was hinting at something deeper. But then actually you then speak to people who make films for a living and they're like, well, it's not enough having something that hints at something. You actually need to fit this into a narrative, into a dramatic narrative, a narrative arc that's going to pay off and give people something to watch. Because I think actually that's what when they watch a film, they don't really think, well, I know I didn't, that's probably the way to, rather than patronising the audience, I'm just going to say that coming into this process as a journalist and not a filmmaker, I hadn't really appreciated how much work actually goes into just giving people something to watch, which isn't a talking head, you know, something, creating a mood, creating a feeling. And so that was the sort of, first year was gathering a lot of evidence, second 2 years were sort of trying to flesh it out into a film.
And you say right near the beginning of the film that actually your initial idea, it's a bit meta actually, the idea of your film. You start off trying to make a film, and the big question that is on your and your co-filmmaker and your mates Jarrod Kimber's lips is test cricket dying.
Yeah.
This has been a topic of discussion, as you point out in the film, for, you know, in the last century and in the century before that, and at various points of crisis. And then of course you find out that actually there's all sorts of things going on, and people who are in positions of great authority and fans and players all point to something, that there is something actually rotten at the heart of cricket, and that cricket is something as a byword for fair play. And you find that there are all sorts of other powers, and the sands are shifting in different directions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, cricket, it's always a bit of a weird notion, isn't it? This concept of the gentleman's game. I mean, cricket is never I'm not sure the colonies felt it was the gentleman's game back when England and Australia were calling the shots back in the day. But yeah, there was this sense of something, which is the outside world is supposed to stand for something. And I suppose, yeah, there were more people we spoke to. And for me personally, I mean, Jarrod's a real expert on this sort of area and had been for several years before. before, but for me it was a real learning process. And it was quite interesting that the more we spoke to different people, you realise actually this is all coming back to the same sort of fundamental thing, which is basically that, you know, the game is run by amateurs. You know, we're talking about like a multi-billion dollar sport, something which has acquired huge value, paradoxically, because, you know, I always think it is a sort of nice paradox that it's us watching the game that is giving it so much value that is then sort of tearing it apart. It's the same with football, isn't it? You know, that, you know, we watch so much that we increase the inequalities. And that's sort of what's happening with cricket. And somehow these guys have crept into positions of power. And you're not quite sure how. I mean, it's like, how have we ended up with a situation where the English Cricket Board, which is an organisation that turns over hundreds of millions of quid a year or whatever, how have we got an unpaid chairman? You know, let's just get someone in that position who knows what they're doing. And sorry, and my opinion, who knows what they're doing. But, you know, and that's basically the position the game is in. It's run by these businessmen who like playing politics. And no one is quite sure who's doing what and why and how and where, and the game sort of lurches from crisis to crisis. And we just happened to come on, start filming at a point where it was lurching towards probably, I would say, the biggest crisis in its history.
Now, I'm a cricket fan and I love to take a day or two to the test matches, the English test matches each summer. So I know the arguments that you're talking about, but what is the crisis that you perceive test match cricket to be in at the moment? What was the reason that you and Jared first took the lens caps off your cameras and went round? What did you think the problem was? And now what do you know the problem to be?
Well, I'd say it's not just Test cricket that's in crisis. Mm. I'd say it's the whole game. We knew that, I suppose what it was, at the beginning we knew that there were, say, 15 or 20 things wrong with the game. It's like, help, Test cricket's getting less competitive. The smaller teams are falling off, you know, looking like they're going to fall off the edge. 2020 is dominating everything, et cetera, et cetera.
So this is the short form of the game where the Test match lasts 5 days.
Yes.
And 2020 is 20 overs, 20 times six.
Yes.
You know, and it's played in the evening. It's played, there's razzmatazz, there's cheerleaders, and
Absolutely. People
play in coloured whites,
yes,
as they have done for many years. But this is a very short form of the game, a very commercially driven form of the game.
Yeah, essentially cricket's tried to become football in the last, you know, they've watched what football has done, which has moved from being a sport to being a you know, real serious entertainment product. And they've said, you know, how the marketeers have said, how can we do this? And that's been, you know, that's coincided with the satellite TV revolution. It's brought in huge amounts of money to the game, mainly in India. So it's unbalanced the game towards the subcontinent, particularly because they've got 1.3 billion people.
There's been this sort of change, balance of power, I suppose, where, you know, it's where there are most eyeballs, where the control of the game goes. But many people would say, well, what's wrong with that?
But the issue is it doesn't have to be like that. You know, that actually cricket is now, I mean, so there's a battle within cricket between the purists, the test fans, and the people who like the young Indian population, for example, who are particularly fond of 2020. But we're not saying one is better than the other. We're actually saying let's find a way to work for the two to work together. Test cricket doesn't make money, 2020 does. So let's allow 2020 to subsidise test cricket. And that's sort of, I suppose, that, you know, the brings us neatly on to the administration of the game, who have who rather than using 2020 as a means of propagating the game, of taking it to new formats, to people who might find 5 days of test cricket rather too much of an entry barrier to become cricket fans, what they're actually doing is entrenching three markets at the top of the game. They're saying, we are only interested in the three television markets within cricket. We're actually going to propagate that. We're going to pack everything in, you know, to fill our coffers, and the rest of the game, who cares? You
know, and those three markets are
England, India, and Australia. I mean, dominant. The
and these
dominant
are three
market
dominant
is India.
Powers yeah. in cricket as well.
Yes.
Do you think? I mean, I've always had this thought that in England we think of cricket as this perhaps a sport played by gents. We think of village greens. We have a historicised view of cricket.
Yes.
Sometimes, not
a romantic, nostalgic.
A romantic, nostalgic view of cricket. We're playing Australia in the middle of the Ashes right now.
Yeah.
Do you think the Australians think the same as the English about cricket? Because we as English, even within this very old-fashioned framework of the Ashes, feel that they perhaps are the pugnacious ones. They have less of history on their side, perhaps, in this, and that they fight keener for it. I mean, do you know what I mean? Even within these two top powers in cricket, do you think there is a shared wisdom on what the game means?
I think we do. I think Australians define themselves through cricket in the same way that the English define themselves through cricket. I think they define themselves in different ways. I mean, it's almost a metaphor for Australian masculinity. masculinity, the way they play cricket, which is what's so interesting, watching the way that they have struggled with, you know, the public have struggled to embrace some of the more metrosexual characters in the Australian team. But I think it has this deep-seated cultural relevance in England and Australia. It's a sort of odd, you know, it is an odd thing that this game can still, for example, make the front page of the Times. Actually, if you took away India, it would be basically the same size as polo, you know, or rugby. Yeah. You know, I mean, it is this weird thing. But with India, it's the second biggest sport in the world. What we're talking about is something which people think of as being this sleepy gentleman's game. But meanwhile, that, you know, they devote all their eyes to moralising about what's happening at FIFA. We're saying, sort of, wake up, realise that actually this sport is now, without you noticing, it's become a, you know, multi-billion dollar market. And it's being, for want of a better word, I don't know if I can say exploited, but I'm just gone ahead and said it. But it is being exploited by its three biggest countries. And the game is being run by individuals who have shown time and time again to have had very serious flawed judgment. And the whole world is up in arms about Sepp Blatter. We're trying to now draw attention and saying, look, the people who are running cricket are in need of scrutiny. Cricket, being the sport which is loved by billions of people and worth billions of pounds or dollars, should rather, you know, have basic governance principles at its head. And these guys have actively compromised that over the last few years. The aim of our film is to draw awareness to that, to basically say to people, look, it is about fighting for what you care about. I mean, we're journalists. I don't personally think that being a journalist is just about picking up a paycheck. You should be calling people to account, speaking truth to power. That's what we're trying to do. And we're trying to encourage the public, whether they're cricket fans or not, to join us on this point of principle. This is something a lot of people care about, and it needs people to stand up for it.
And let me ask you a question then, with your journalists rather than your cricket fans, Hassan. Yeah. At what point in the, and we have three of the big cheeses in the administration of cricket who take part in your film, and many other much loved commentators and former players and all the rest of it,
sure,
appear as talking heads in your film as well. At what point in the film did you, or in the film, or the making of the film, did you think, oh God, we've actually got a live one here? You know, this is, you know, we've got people saying things on camera that I'm amazed that they've said. There's a lot of, for a much mediated game, and a much mediated administrative level of the game, there are some kind of howlers in this. I mean, there are some real takeaway quotes from some of the key people that give away the funds and administer to the international game here. At what point did you think, wow, this film has turned into something else?
Well, I think the great thing about documentary is it's not just about what people say. In print, it's what people say. On screen, it's how they say it. And so I think we knew that the administrators, the moment they opened their mouths, the moment we got the interviews, we thought, okay, look, they've underestimated us. They think we're idiots. They're probably right, but, you know, we're going to get them on camera. So then we're going to get some clever people to tell us how to use the footage right. I suppose the point that I really realised that we had the film that we wanted to make was the point where we realised that we could actually show that these guys were contracting the sport. Because for people who don't care about cricket or understand cricket, once you realise that this thing is being actively contracted, is actively contracting, that, you know, they're shrinking the number of teams playing in its world, in their world events. They're refusing millions of dollars of free money from cricket going to the Olympics. And they are essentially then restructuring world cricket to award themselves three countries over 50% of cricket's revenues, while the other 102 countries share the remaining 48%. That point, when you say, yeah, okay, someone who doesn't care about this, my wife is going to come out of the cinema and go, I understand that there's a problem here. That was the moment, you know, and having those individuals, those villains and the heroes as well, you know, but the fact that the some of these guys did play the villains' roles very well without us having to edit them. We haven't cut them up, and we've just manifested what they showed, what they said. You know, so it was there were a lot of nice moments in the cutting room.
And if you're a consultant to the game, if you're employed by the ICC, the International Cricket Council, or the English Cricket Board, or whatever it might be in any country, or any of the top countries, I suppose, what would be your fix?
My fix would be get people at the top making decisions for the right reasons. When money is being spent at Monocle, I presume that when you guys get money, that money is then accountable. You have budgets. It's transparent. You know, so when the billions of dollars come into cricket, let's understand how that money is spent and who is spending it.
You see my Maserati in the car park. Thank you for noticing.
Yeah. Look, it's the thing is that these things, people tend to really overcomplicate things. Generally, nothing is a cure-all, but you've got the best chance of fixing it if you get the right people making the right decisions for non-short-term reasons. You know, cricket is this incredible game with all these wonderful, three different wonderful formats of it, with the love of 1.3 billion Indians and a whole load of other countries around the world. If we grow that game, then cricket can't fail. What's happening at the moment is the game is not growing, it's contracting. By extension, it's dying, and we need to address that. So that's why we hope people will understand what we're trying to do, sign our petition, take this issue above, you know, cricket, take it to politicians, take it to the news pages and say, look, let's stand up for something which is a metaphor for everything people care about.
And just on a personal note, it's deeply saddening that cricket, you know, having grown up watching on the television here in the UK, it's not on free-to-air television. Is that a quick fix to stop Test cricket from dying, putting it on the television?
Yeah, absolutely.
We have these things called crown jewels in sport, don't we, in the UK. It's amazing that the Ashes isn't one of those, but the boat race is.
Yeah, you see, I would argue that is a classic example of administrative incompetence. And that's what happens when you get people making these decisions who think that they know best without any checks and balances. If you were a really progressive administrator in this era, you would have understood that it's not down to you that television rights have gone through the roof. That's a global trend. So what you would do is you create competition, you bid networks up against each other, you then retain digital rights, pump it out for free, get people watching your product. If people aren't watching it, then again, it's dying. That's what's happening in this country. And some of the decisions that's been made by the English Cricket Board in the last 10 years are absolutely catastrophic, is not strong enough. The participation in this country is down. The viewership numbers in this country are down. Even on Sky, they are falling. Kids nowadays do not understand what cricket is. It's a parable for modern times. It's what happens if you take the short-term dollar. And we've got to wake up. They've got to wake up.
And just lastly, you might have been asked this before, Sam, but when people tell you that, you know, when people be clever and say, well, you know, cricket was invented for people to bet on, and W.G. Grace put the bails back on when he was bowled out and said people didn't come to see you bowl, they came to see me bat. Yeah. What do you say to them?
Well, I say, look, cricket constantly, of course, it's never been the gentleman's game as such, but, you know, that doesn't mean that, you know, look, if we grow the game, we're never going to stop people betting. We can't stop, you know, any sport is only as pure as the people who play it. But the whole point of governance is to put rules in place around things that people care about to stop us destroying them. So let's have some proper governance and then we can just get on with enjoying a great game.
Sam Collins is the co-director and co-producer of Death of a Gentleman. It's a fantastic film. And Sam, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And there we have it, Andrew. That was edition 318 of the Monocle Weekly. Was it a classic? Where do you think it rates? Is it in the top three tens?
Yeah, I think so. Any time that Peter York comes on, it's always, always entertaining. He always has a good turn of phrase.
He's excellent. I'm sure we both and all our listeners wish him the best of luck going to the Edinburgh Assembly Rooms with his show.
We are definitely going to go and see it.
And we're going to have a bit of a group outing to go and cheer him on from the sidelines. And I'm going to be worried, actually, next time we do a programme with Peter, that I'm not kind of properly sort of up to sartorial scratch.
No, he's very good. He kind of gives you the once up and down, and then he forgives you.
I saw a thing that in the prelude, and I read some notes surrounding his show, and it was about sportswear. Nothing that you wear should be derived from sports. It was something that I sort of always used to think myself, but now I've got the sneakers.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's because we're sneakerheads, aren't we?
Sneakerheads. As discussed on edition 317 of the Monocle Weekly. However, that was edition 318. Let's thank our friends behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall, our studio manager. Was Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly will be back at the same time, same place next week. For the time being, I've been Robert Bound.
And I'm still Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.